Good morning, Gordon.
Good morning, John. John has texted Rick. Lydia's texted.
Rick.
Is he texting?
And Peter. No, Rick is not with us yet. And Victoria.
Peter and then Victoria.
Puzzle, Gordon. Do we have enough material for Victoria to go two segments?
Sure.
Because Peter we do, and Rick we don't. Rick is one segment, the setup in the conference.
The AI.
Yeah, all right. You explained to Victoria that it's 20 minutes then.
Right, it's the two segments.
Okay, thank you.
I mean, there's so much to talk about with Victoria that we can add any topic.
Well, and right, but I'd like to keep them discreet. This for that, one segment for one for Asia and one segment for Europe, or vice versa. Anyway, but not to mix and match.
Okay.
So we'll begin with what you have for her on the beginning.
Which is Strait of Hormuz.
Strait of Hormuz. So we'll start there. Certainly enough puzzles.
And then the other one is China, are China and Russia the victors of the Iran war?
Correct.
Which is related.
Which takes us to Asia.
Yeah. It's a related topic, but it is certainly a big one.
Oh, no, it's superpowers. I understand. And with Rick, we're starting with the World Artificial Intelligence Conference. The numbers coming in from China are dreadful, and they're not changing. And so I'll start with that. The latest numbers we have, the 4. What was it? What were they guessing?
4.3.
Which we can translate into unemployment, despair, abandonment, disregard, disruption.
And right. Yeah, the Rhodium Group says it's 0 to 1.
I've read recession, small R.
Yeah, I think it's contraction, but I don't know. You know, I don't think anybody knows really.
No, I've read that on the street. It's part of the debate. It's not far fetched. Nobody's
gonna... No, by no means is it far fetched.
Right. All right. Here's Rick, and we have good morning, Matt. Rick.
Good morning.
We have
good morning, gentlemen.
The world
good morning, Rick.
And
I can hear you, but
do you see and hear everything, Rick?
There.
Okay. Rick, are you there for all?
There seems to be a latency.
Well, that shouldn't be. I don't hear any latency for you. Go off and come back then.
Okay.
We'll start when we hit 8, Gordon, and he'll come back to us. You hear me fine, Gordon.
Perfect.
Yeah. All right, it's 8 a.m., and the boys and girls are ready to come on with the show. There we go. And a good day to you. This is the making of the John Batchelor Show and the John Batchelor Show. We have headlines from Europe that are critical to understand the day ahead of us in North America. The one that attracts my attention immediately is $95. Oil rises past $95 after Trump threatens further Iran escalation. That's within the last hours. We also have headlines asking, where is the $13 billion that U.S. has collected from Venezuela oil? A good question, given that the Pentagon is now seeking additional funds for the Iran war, Mr. Hegseth was remarking on, same within these last 24 hours. We also have an issue that will become increasingly recognizable. The way the headline is written in the Financial Times is not without entertainment. Artificial intelligence. OpenAI admits AI agent, in quotes, caused major cyber breach by itself. This is the first time I've ever seen fault-finding among a non-human event. Agent, that is our new adversary here, an agent. Does it have a name? Is it a personality? Is it seeking to help? Is it misunderstood? It caused a major cyber breach by itself. That seems unusual, and that is a subject for us today. I welcome Gordon Chang, at Gordon G. Chang, my colleague and co-host. Gordon, we have agents to blame for disruptions in the atmosphere, and so it'll be a new way of fault-finding. I can see the 3- and 4-year-olds of America taking this up as a cause. I didn't do it, the agent did it. Or Puppy didn't do it, the agent did it. All right, we welcome Rick Fisher of the International Assessment and Strategy Center, because it just so happens there is a related issue. Mighty good timing here, Rick. Good morning to you. Rick Fisher
good morning, John.
Is a senior fellow, and he's going to take all of his considerable keep-a-straight-face to give us this next topic. Xi Jinping, who doesn't travel much anymore, he stays in Beijing to keep his eye on the guy behind him, is now launching the World Artificial Intelligence Cooperation Agreement. It has an unusual acronym in English, which I won't attempt, but in any event, it appears to be someone had a bright idea in the Chinese Communist Party, and they all looked at each other and say, do you think we can sell it? Rick, what is the World Artificial Intelligence Cooperation Initiative? Good day to you, Rick.
Good day, John. Good day, Gordon. The WICO, World Artificial Intelligence Cooperation Organization, is the latest in a long line of Chinese Communist Party origin, proto-alliance, NGO confabs to address a particular area of power of concern to the Chinese Communist Party, of course, in this case, artificial intelligence. And in a sense, taking its cue from the Shanghai Cooperation Organization that was founded in 2001, the WICO hopes to assemble a large coalition of pro-China countries behind the technology that China sells, the standards that China sets. And in doing so, these countries will be weaving themselves even further into the fabric of global Chinese Communist Party ambitions for global hegemony.
So I can regard this as a Chinese AI version of the Artemis program. Yes, sign up and you get to be part of our side. Gordon, we're going to start immediately, and I'm going to come to you because framing this is important, and I'm going to ask immediately you report on the Chinese economy, which to my amateur eyes looks desperate, and that can't be ruled out as what Rick just introduced, which was a new gambit to only talk about the high end and not at all admit to the unemployment, the despair, the failure, and the manufacturing overcapacity. All right, I'll come to you, and then we'll go to Rick. This is 8 to 9 minutes for tonight, Rick. All set? Here we go.
All set.
Five. This is the making of the show, about to become the show itself. 5, 4, 3, 2, 1. I'm John Batchelor. I welcome Gordon Chang at Gordon G. Chang, my colleague and co-host. And we're looking at the Chinese economy because China has a better idea all the time, every 30 days, as to how to get out of the hole we've created with our false promises and our overcapacity on the factory floor. Gordon, a very good day to you. Before we go to our colleague Rick Fisher about a new gambit from Beijing introduced by Xi Jinping to do with AI, what is the professional opinion of the Chinese economy right now? Are they digging out or are they digging the hole deeper? Good day to you, Gordon.
Good day, John and Rick. China's going deeper into the hole. Its economy is plunging. It reported 4.3% year-on-year GDP growth in the second quarter. But although that is down from its 5.0% report for the first quarter, what we're seeing is an economy that is maybe growing at 1%, maybe at zero, could even be contracting. There are very distressing signs out of the economy. The bright spots are exports. They're high tech. There's EVs and all sorts of things. But the core of the economy is plunging. And that's a problem for Xi Jinping because he now has what's called K-shaped in the U.S. He calls a dual circulation. It's a disaster.
Rick, a very good day to you. The World Artificial Intelligence Cooperation Organization is all new to me. I believe it's new to everybody. Most striking about this, it was announced by Xi Jinping himself and other dignitaries of the Chinese Communist Party. And as I understand it, according to the diplomat, the Secretary General of the UN and the Deputy Prime Minister of Kazakhstan attended. So there's some momentum for transnational cooperation. However, what is the World Artificial Intelligence Cooperation Organization? I believe it's new to my ears. Good day to you, Rick.
Good day, John. Good day, Gordon. World Artificial Intelligence Cooperation Organization, or WICO, was announced by the Chinese Communist Party about a year ago. And it's taken them that long till now to pull it together and to convince 29 countries to sign on. It is in the vein of the Shanghai Cooperation Organization, China's latest attempt to envelop itself in an area of power of concern to the party. And of course, artificial intelligence is going to be pervasive, affecting everything, as you've mentioned. And the Chinese want to be there to help set the rules, to peddle its AI technology, to make as many countries as possible become dependent on Chinese AI technology. And so far, one-third of the countries that have signed on for WICO are also members of the Shanghai Cooperation Organization, whose main product has been to produce anti-democratic oaths and very large military exercises that have aided the modernization of the People's Liberation Army.
Gordon, you have a question for Rick about the WICO.
Rick, this is headquartered in Shanghai. Antonio Guterres, the UN Secretary General, was there. Is this organization a UN one, or is this just China-sponsored?
Well, Gordon, eventually the Chinese hope that those are one and the same. The Chinese are enveloping them, the United Nations. They are basically in control. They're the largest funder. They're always pushing their people into every corner. So when the UN becomes a center for artificial intelligence rules, which Guterres hopes, then the Chinese are going to be right there saying, "Okay, you carry on with that, but we're standing in the background here pulling all the strings."
Rick, this is a puzzle. Why do we need a WICO? What's happened? Is there a mission statement other than the fact that Xi Jinping gets to address the body once a year? What else can it achieve that we're not now watching achieved by private enterprise?
Well, of course, John. I mean, private enterprise is simply not intelligent enough for artificial intelligence. The Chinese Communist Party is far more intelligent and is going to make sure that our artificial intelligence is the best. And if we question that, then boom, off our internet goes.
It occurs to me, Gordon, that it might be time for us to form a World Risk Board Game cooperation organization so we can declare ourselves the best risk players that ever arrived, but you're free to join us, and we could sign up the same 29 countries. This is a mockery of transnational cooperation, Gordon. Is that apparent to the UN, to your understanding? Is that apparent to everybody watching this creation?
Unfortunately not. The UN does love to have multilateral organizations that set rules for everybody. And this is a danger because, as you know, China sets AI rules. Those rules are not going to be good for democratic nations. They're not going to be good for the healthy development of AI. And what the United States needs to do is to keep our AI ahead of the Chinese. Now, our lead on models is slim, as we saw from the introduction of Kimi just a couple days ago. But we do have a big lead on chips, and we need to make sure that we don't allow those chips into China's hands. And unfortunately, the Trump administration is issuing export permits for NVIDIA's H200 chip to China.
You have a question for Rick. We have a couple of minutes.
Rick, what can the United States do?
Well, as you say, Gordon, stay ahead. That's one thing. But that often is not enough. At some point, we're going to have to go up against not only the nefarious aspects of China's AI ecosystem, but we're going to have to contain the WICO and inveigh our allies not to join this nth number Chinese gambit for future hegemony.
Gordon, one more question about the Chinese economy. They boast about their high end. There's an old metaphor called Potemkin. I think you know where I'm going. Is that a Potemkin village, the high end? Because to my last check, they don't have the NVIDIA materials they need to build high end. They have to borrow them, acquire them in some fashion, find them falling off a truck somewhere. So this is not a Chinese creation. This is an NVIDIA creation that China is claiming to organize. Is that correct, how to look at this? We have 30 seconds.
Yeah, I think China certainly has some real accomplishments. And in some areas, they are ahead. Their manufacturing sector is better than anybody else's. So I wouldn't say Potemkin, but I would say that it is not big enough to carry the rest of the Chinese economy. As they say, there are islands of excellence. And just a year or two ago, they only constituted 6% of GDP. So the issue, there are a couple of issues here, but we do have to stay ahead. And we have to improve our manufacturing because the Chinese are pretty good at it.
Rick Fisher of the International Assessment and Strategy Center introducing us to Waco, not a city in Texas. Gordon Chang at Gordon G. Chang. I'm John Batchelor. Hey, Rick, thank you.
That was fun, John. Thank you.
I hope you get your Waco badge so you can display it for us.
Well, let's hope that in 2 years' time you're not working for Waco, John.
I understand, but you're not nothing if you don't have a gift bag. I hope it's a high quality gift bag for joining up. Thank you, Rick.
Indeed, Gouge. All right, have a great
Thanks,
day.
Rick.
Good day to you. And we're joined by Mr. Husey, I believe. I think he's there. Am I still with us? I'm still. Gordon, you still hear me?
I still hear you.
All right. Mr. Husey is here. Peter, a good day to you.
It's always good to start the morning off with Rick Fisher.
So far, I haven't pushed the wrong button, so I greet you. I'm going to get away from this as fast as possible. The prompt has a mind of its own. We're headed immediately to deterrence and risk, but I wanted to make sure there wasn't risk in this program. You know, Rick, Gordon and Peter, it occurs to me that there should be an eye test or something for us seniors before they give us something as powerful as the artificial intelligence inside an iMac. It's way too. It's like I'm being asked to drive a sports car, and I don't know how a gear stick works. I mean, really, there's some aspects of this screen that frighten me. But so far, we're okay. Okay, Gordon, we're set up. I haven't sabotaged this yet. It's always that risk. We were just spending time entertaining ourselves, Peter, with the World Artificial Intelligence Cooperation Organization, another bright idea out of Beijing as to how to reorganize the desk chairs in our classroom. Gordon, this is like super regulation. Is that how to regard it?
Oh, yes. And it's regulation by China and probably with the backing of the UN. So, yeah, this is, can get dangerous.
And, Peter, wouldn't China like to organize world-organized nuclear weapons? Wouldn't that be something? The World Nuclear Weapons Organization, Cooperation Organization, headed by China out of Beijing. Wouldn't that be a dream for them?
Yeah, they have them. We don't.
Yeah, it'd look like that, but you're putting it, you know, much, much too bluntly. All right, we'll begin immediately. The politics of the moment include an organization called the DSA. People use it casually these days because it's become a friend. That is, a rhetorical friend. But it stands for the Democratic Socialists of America. It is a party, an agreement, a celebration. It reminds me, gentlemen, because we were educated in the 20th century, reminds me of something like the Weather People. Do you recall that, everybody, the Weather People?
Oh, absolutely.
You would talk about them, but they didn't really exist. I mean, it was sort of an idea that would show up now and again. And it had a great power for a while because it seemed to be attached to disruptions in order, to do with Vietnam chiefly, but there were other aspects. The DSA is like that. It pops up. I don't know what the organization skill is behind it, but we're about to direct it towards something very serious, which is the triad. So I begin immediately. Gordon, you all set?
I'm all set.
Peter, I'll come right to you and ask, what is the triad that is the target of rhetoric from the DSA, all right? And we'll introduce it that way. Five. This is 8 to 9 minutes for tonight, gentlemen. Thank you. Five, four, three, two, one. I'm John Batchelor, Gordon Chang at Gordon G. Chang, my colleague and co-host. We welcome Peter Husey. Peter is of geostrategic analysis and a fellow at the National Institute for Deterrent Studies. He's going to help us understand the unpacking of an acronym. The acronym is DSA. In addition to DSA, there are other acronyms that describe the triad. I could use all of them, but the triad is enough to get to the heart of it. Peter, a very good day to you. What is the triad that is disturbing to the DSA? What is the DSA to the triad? And is this fresh rhetoric coming from our political troublemakers? Good day to you, Peter.
Good day, John, and Gordon, good to see you as well. The nuclear triad is very simply our bombers, submarines, and ICBMs, land-based ICBMs, which is a three-part stool on which our nuclear deterrent has rested since basically the late 1950s, early 1960s, when the, believe it or not, the current system in the ground, the ICBMs were built, B-52s were built, and then it was a little bit later in 1982, the first Ohio-class submarine went in. So that's our triad. Now, what are the Democratic Socialists of America? What are they up to? Well, they're U.S. Senate and U.S. House people have introduced a bill destroying the triad. They have proposed 150, not 400 ICBMs, four submarines, not 12, and no bombers. And when you add it up and you look at it, they're talking about a little over 200 missiles versus the 800 we were allowed under the New START Treaty. And it basically would put us at a level of warheads, well, compatible with less than China, 10% of what Russia has, and equivalent to what North Korea has. At least I've seen some estimates about North Korea having a large arsenal compared to where they were 10 years ago. So basically, it's unilateral disarmament, and Bernie Sanders is the primary sponsor, along with Elizabeth Warren, along with Mr. Markey from Massachusetts. And in the House, it's Mr. Khanna and it's Mr. Garamendi, both members of the House Armed Services Committee.
Gordon, you have a question for Peter about what appears to be a return to the future. I believe that the 20th century was dominated by no nuke thinking and marching and demonstrations from here to Europe. Go ahead, Gordon.
Peter, a number of those names you mentioned, for instance, Markey, Ro Khanna, Elizabeth Warren, they're not DSA. So does this proposal have any resonance in the Democratic Party as a whole?
No, it doesn't. It did not yet, thank God. But what it does is that they've noticed in the DSA rhetoric, we keep hearing the word defund the military. That's new. And the only specific thing that Mr. Sanders and company are talking about is this amendment they offered in the House and Senate in October of last year. It hasn't had a hearing yet, hasn't been voted on, but this is the DSA agenda, which is disarmament, though they don't call it that. They just say that we don't need what we now have. We can go down unilaterally. This is a unilateral proposal. It's not a joint proposal. And it's not unlike the nuclear freeze of the Reagan era. And it's not unlike Ban the Bomb, which came out during the 1950s. So this is, as Gordon said, I mean, as John said, we're going back to the future, is that there have been pushes towards disarmament all through American, the nuclear age. But what is different here is that it's twofold. One, eliminate our deterrent unilaterally by going down to very, very low numbers. But even worse than that is we're seeing a push to get rid of the idea of nuclear deterrence itself and rely on some other unknown, unstated deterrent, perhaps just conventional weapons, maybe cyber, maybe something else. But this is the new part of what we're seeing is the trashing of the whole idea of nuclear deterrence itself, which started with the Oppenheimer movie and then Annie Jacobson's book on nuclear stuff, and then also in Dynamite and in a number of other shows that are movies that are coming up, just a couple just recently. And that's part of a campaign to denigrate the whole idea of nuclear deterrence.
Peter, it occurs to me, having never heard of this before, defund the triad. It does have entertaining moments here, but in any event, it occurs to me that this is an opportunity to educate our younger colleagues as to exactly what has happened since 1945 about nuclear weapons, because they come to this without, it appears, much background. They're just jumping into it as if, you know, somebody found a warehouse of Ban the Bomb signs, and they say, hey, we can use these, you know, something like that.
Well, I agree with you. It is. I have a general friend who's retired, General Herensack, who's speaking in October at my seminar series, and his subject is going to be the miseducation of America on nuclear deterrence. And he had some very senior positions. He was a 3-star general, extraordinary individual, steeped in the nuclear business, but he's going to talk about the fact that when you look at how our students are being taught in high school and college and graduate school, even in the service academies, there's a huge miseducation in terms of the nuclear deterrent. And he one of his things, why he's been very supportive of the work I do, is that he's been trying to say we need to get this education right. And shows like yours are a big step in that direction. But as you know, as Rick Fisher will tell you, your previous guest, the miseducation with respect to nuclear forces and deterrence is very widespread.
Gordon, you have a question.
Throughout the Cold War, we had fewer warheads than the Soviet Union, and yet we were able to deter them. Now, it seems it's no longer a bipolar situation. We have, in addition to the Russian Federation, we've got China, North Korea, God knows what else is out there. We're never going to have parity with our adversaries and enemies. What do we need in terms of, let's say, a proportional size of arsenals in order to maintain nuclear deterrence? Because that's going to be the issue when the Sanders proposal comes up.
We have a little more than a minute, Peter, a little more than 1 minute.
Yeah, this issue is central to the issue we're now facing. The Strategic Posture Commission in 2023 in October issued a report that addressed exactly the question you asked, Gordon. And that is, we don't have to match them warhead for warhead, but if your deterrent policy is to hold at risk the leadership, their nuclear forces, their top conventional forces, and the industry that supports them and the security forces that support them, you need X number of warheads. That is more than what we now have, but it doesn't, we don't need to match warhead for warhead. But the issue, and I've written about this, I would say, as much as anyone, is do numbers matter? I think numbers do matter. You don't have to match them warhead for warhead, but the numbers you have now are inadequate to maintain your deterrent as we go into the future. Now, I think our nuclear people in Omaha and other places would say our deterrent is okay now, but in a very short number of years, it has to be increased and enhanced and modernized. Otherwise, we will fall seriously behind.
Peter Husey is president of Geostrategic Analysis. He's at the Gold Institute for International Strategy and a fellow at the National Institute for Deterrence Studies, Gordon Chang, at Gordon G. Chang. I'm John Batchelor. I had to bite my tongue. I was ready to charge in there with a better idea, which is that before DSA gets to debate, it has to watch Dr. Strangelove 15 times in a row. Okay. This is like the bar of entry, because we're just catching up to how many times we've enjoyed it. And
well, there's not only is Threads out, but there's a movie being screened at the Carnegie Endowment today, which is about the, it's very strange. It's about the period in Reykjavik between Reagan and Gorbachev. And the theme is that we were about ready to go to nuclear war, which in 1986, we were not. I mean, it was, I don't know where, I mean, George Perkovich is at Carnegie. He's, you know, he is on the left. He is in favor of global abolition of nukes. But this is basically, we were going to blow the world up, and we just averted Armageddon because Gorbachev and Reagan sat down at Reykjavik and talked about getting rid of nukes. But they didn't talk about getting rid of nukes. They talked about getting rid of missiles, what we call fast flyers. They weren't including bombers, and then it didn't include any other country except the United States and Russia.
Peter,
that's why it was a little strange, but you, I understand what Reagan was up to.
You understand why they're rewriting history. That's the, you know, the future is assured. It's the past that frightens us. So they're
very applying, well said.
They're applying George Orwell logic: control the past and you control the present.
Absolutely, they are rewriting it, and it's a national pastime among, unfortunately, the left.
I know, but it's Peter. Look at all the work you have. Good heavens! Come on, Peter. Come on. How long has it been since you got to talk about Ban the Bomb? And what fun this is!
Yeah, well, I am writing a book. Mike Pillsbury keeps telling me to, kicking me in the you know what to get it going. But it's called Windows.
Right.
It's the window of vulnerability that Reagan talked about, and the new window of vulnerability, which we allude to a little bit. And the question is, Reagan solved his window, but I don't know how we're going to solve this one because it's tougher.
Thank you, Peter. We'll return to this subject later, and I want to talk about Threads. I have new thinking about it. My goodness, what a movie. 1984, Sheffield, England. My goodness.
I watched it. It was not just frightening, but what was extraordinary about it was the number of the times that children were being born.
Oh, everything about it.
And it was like in the midst of this horrible death, you have life. But then at the end, of course, I won't spill it for other people, but it is a gruesome movie.
Yes. Peter and I are talking about a movie that was made in 1980. Well, it was released in 1984 at the height of the fear of Soviet-U.S. nuclear exchange.
Yes, and it was at the height of the campaign to deploy INF missiles in Europe.
Right.
That's which is why it was made, was to basically take down Margaret Thatcher.
Peter, we will talk later. We're moving on to...
Yes, we'll see you. And Gordon, good to see you, sir, as always.
Thanks, Peter.
See you later, John. Take care.
Yes, Peter, thank you. I haven't made any mistakes yet, but I'm going to take a risk here. See, Peter leaves, and Victoria's not with us yet, so we'll... here she is.
I don't know what's going on with my camera, John.
Oh, hi, Victoria.
Hi.
I hear you clearly.
Yes.
Beg pardon.
But I don't know what's going on.
I don't think I can do anything because all I have is the prompt to remove, and I certainly don't want to do that.
I might have to leave and come back in if that's okay.
That's excellent. Thank you. Good idea, Victoria. We're patiently waiting for you. Gordon, we're turning to first the Straits of Hormuz and then to the larger question of Russia and China behind the Iranian regime, the Islamic Republic. The headline I've already read to you earlier, oil rises past $95 after Trump threatens from further Iran escalation. As I understand it, in these last hours, critical to understand is the Houthis getting involved in threatening the Baba Mandeb. She is. It worked.
But I can't tell what's going on.
It worked perfectly, Victoria. Good morning to you. Thank you.
Good morning, gentlemen.
I hear you.
Good morning, Victoria.
I see you perfectly. It's wonderful to welcome you, even if the subject is a little gritty. The headline that I'm going to read to start our conversation about the Strait of Hormuz, and then we'll move to the larger question of China and Russia behind the conflicts in the Middle East. Oil rises past $95 after Trump threatens further Iran escalation, is the Financial Times. I'll start there, Victoria, and come right to you about the Houthis, Iran, and the U.S. and our allies being pummeled, I believe, by Iran. There was talk yesterday of a 10-day pause in the conflict, but I believe that that is not now current. We'll explore that. Here we go. Five.
This Sounds is good.
19 minutes for tonight, two parts. The second part will be devoted to the powers, Beijing and Moscow, working together in some fashion. Five, four, three. Gordon, you hear everything perfectly?
I do.
All right. Two, one. I'm John Batchelor. Gordon Chang at Gordon G. Chang, my colleague and co-host. War in the Straits of Hormuz. War in Eurasia. War in Europe. All of these topics become one some when the U.S. gets involved in the conflicts. We welcome Victoria Coates, Vice President of the Heritage Foundation, a former Deputy National Security Advisor. Victoria, very good day to you. I begin with the headline that applies to the war in the Strait of Hormuz. Oil rises past $95 after Trump threatens further Iran escalation. That's the Financial Times, London, reporting to the markets, not having room enough in the headline to mention that Iran more than threatened escalation, deliberately signed on the Houthis to attack the Baba Mandeb in the Red Sea, which is the other choke point in the Arabian Peninsula, critical because that is chiefly the exit, the Red Sea, used by Saudi Arabia, our ally, to get its oil out, not the Persian Gulf. So right now, your measure of this, what appears to be endless conflict, we shoot infrastructure, Iran attacks the neighborhood, infrastructure such as desalination plants. Do you see an exit? Good evening to you, Victoria. Thank you.
Well, good day to you, John, and to you too, Gordon. Yes, this is definitely an escalation on the part of the Iranians. And quite frankly, I've been wondering for some time why they didn't play what you might call the Houthi card, because they're on the western edge in Yemen of the Arabian Peninsula, controlling, as you said, the Bab al-Mandeb Strait out of the Red Sea. And Saudi Arabia has been pumping about 5 million barrels a day through their Petroline east-west pipeline from Abqaiq to Yabun. And then they can take that out by ship through Bab al-Mandeb. So that's about a quarter of what normally comes out of the Persian Gulf. So it's been a major mitigating factor for what the Iranians have been doing in the strait. Now, it's not entirely clear to me just how much the Houthi can do. They are not the Iranians by any stretch of the imagination. They do have some sophisticated weaponry that Iran has provided to them, but that supply has got to have dried up in recent months. So they have a somewhat limited inventory, and they're not as organized as the IRGC, as the Iranian military. So I think you're going to see a lot of testing in the next day or two. Certainly, the United States has actions we can take against the Houthi, as do some of our allies, including Saudi Arabia, but also Egypt, which has a significant navy in the Red Sea.
Gordon, you have a question for Victoria.
Victoria, what can the United States do with the Houthis?
Oh, I mean, we know where they are. So you can do a lot of targeted bombing of Yemen. It hasn't really been worth it up until now to do that. But quite frankly, I'd like to get that problem cleaned up. The Houthi have been problematic in the past. They are deliberately starving and tormenting the people of Yemen. And we've seen in the last couple of days something called the Free Yemen Movement, another armed militia emerge. Now, I don't think that by any stretch of the imagination, these guys are going to be George Washington and the Continental Army, but they're not the Houthi. And it does show that the Houthi's grip on Yemen may not be as secure as we think. And so they might not be terribly difficult to dislodge.
Victoria, is this a war between Saudi Arabia and Yemen, or is this part of the Iran conflict with the U.S.? It becomes very difficult to know whether the Houthis are involved because they've got a personal beef on MBS or because they're saluting and marching to the orders from Tehran. And then again, is it significant that we make that distinction?
Well, I was just going to say, John, I would embrace the and on this one. The relationship between the Houthi, who are kind of a bizarre Shia sect, and the regime in Tehran has always been a little bit odd. They don't really match up theologically, but it's been a relationship of convenience. The Houthi have needed the supplies. The Iranians like being able to harass shipping in the Red Sea. So they kind of meet up there. And at the same time, yes, the biggest beef that the Houthi have is with MBS, with the House of Saud, with their Sunni control of the two mosques in Saudi Arabia, Mecca and Medina. So that is nice for the Houthi from their perspective that they get to do something bad to Saudi Arabia, which also satisfies their patrons in Tehran.
And there was an artificial truce for some time, and we can believe that that is now broken because the Houthis claim that Saudi Arabia fired first, you know, that usual Hatfield and McCoy, who shot first. But do we believe that the truce is gone between them?
I think it probably is because this is from the Saudi perspective, business. And what the Houthi are doing is bad for business, and that's not something they can tolerate for a long period of time. So, we've had some, tensions flaring up in Yemen periodically, really over the last 8, 9 years. It's been going on for quite some time since the UN-recognized government fell of Yemen. So that's going to have, that's a situation that really, as I said before, needs cleaning up just because it's a humanitarian disaster. It's a threat to global commerce, and certainly a threat to the oil markets, given how the ways the Saudis have been using the Red Sea.
Gordon, you have a question.
Victoria, there have been these periodic hints that the United States or Israel or somebody would help fuel the Kurds in their struggle against Iran. Is there a similar strategy with regard to the Houthis? Because you do mention this Free Yemen movement. Do you think that there's some possibility there?
Well, there is. I mean, there have been, various attempts to organize the folks in southern Yemen, Gordon, and that could be built on. And there's a major also in that region counterterrorism. There's ISIS down there and some other bad Islamic extremists that also need to be taken care of. That's where UAE had been particularly active and a very good partner to us in that necessary work. So, if the Houthi are starting to lose their grip, as I said, because of their serial mismanagement, I mean, they're horrible overlords. Nobody likes them. And so it might be possible at this point, as I said before, to dislodge them. But that's going to be some difficult work. We're going to need the UAE and Saudi to get on the same page about what's next for Yemen and, let them really manage that because it is their backyard.
And now you introduce a mystery to me, Victoria. I need help here. I understand there are a number of long-running disputes, sometimes called feuds, in the Gulf Cooperation Council. I think you just named one of them, MBS and MBZ. UAE and Saudi Arabia do not work smoothly together. It would be far-fetched, I'm told, to call them allies. Is there evidence of a new friction in the Gulf Cooperation Council? We remember, what, 10 years ago, maybe more than 10 years ago, the GCC was disdainful of Yemen and took sides that were opposed to the then Yemen government of Saleh. Is that friction still involved in all of this talk of Iran? In other words, our allies are not necessarily on the same page as us.
Well, I actually think they are on the same page as us, John, but I think that they definitely have internal frictions. That's entirely accurate. So, you know, MBS and MBZ have historically gotten along pretty well, so that is possible. Right now, they seem to be pretty much at loggerheads. Bear in mind, the Saudis were not at all pleased that UAE got out of OPEC, and UAE is now managing their oil production independently of OPEC, of the organization. And so they're going to go up to, I think, about 5 million barrels a day. And so that will bring prices down. Saudi doesn't always like that. Again, bad for business. But I'm old enough to remember 2017 when we had the Gulf Rift between then UAE and Saudi on one side and Qatar on the other. And you know, at that point, when I was in the Trump administration, we were being furiously lobbied by both sides to pick a side. And President Trump's message to the entire administration was, I refuse. I need all my Gulf allies. I need them to start pulling together. And we had years of patient diplomacy and eventually got that situation resolved in 2020. So I think you're going to see something similar here. The Iranians, we may need to nominate them for a peace prize because they are bringing folks together. They're shelling everyone indiscriminately, including Qatar and Oman, who are traditionally the countries in the GCC that are closest to them. So we'll see what happens. It's inconvenient for us to have that friction between Saudi and UAE right now because we do need them both in this fight. But I'm pretty confident that the one person who can actually make the situation right is Donald Trump.
Victoria Coates of the Heritage Foundation introducing the powers. And so we'll go to them. One's in Beijing, the other one's in Moscow. Gordon Chang at Gordon G. Chang. I'm John Batchelor. I'm John Batchelor with Gordon Chang, my colleague and co-host, and we're very privileged to speak with Victoria Coates, who is the vice president of the Heritage Foundation and a former deputy national security advisor of the first Trump term. Victoria, you mentioned the Chinese. I mentioned the Chinese. The puzzle here is what's in it for them. They have now and again shown their hands by resupplying in the Iran war, for example, and we can guess that they are involved in Iran's fate, the Ukraine war. They're involved in Iran's fate because they have a long-term deal to buy Iranian oil, and they'd like that reestablished and none of this Strait of Hormuz blocking. However, what is it right now, the mission statement that Beijing tells itself getting involved, and how involved is also a question.
No, it's very interesting. And I, you know, am a little unclear about quite how China's going to play its hand here. Yes, they like that stream of discounted oil out of Iran. And then Iran is basically beholden to spend the money they get for the oil on Chinese goods. So it's what I call an unvirtuous cycle. And that's been going on for some time now, really since 2021. And, you know, that is of benefit to China. But they've also really curbed their purchases of Iranian oil. And I'm not quite sure where they're making that up. It might be increased purchases of Russian oil. But the Russia-China relationship seems to me in a much stronger position than China-Iran. Because if you look at Iran, you know, it's such a mess economically. And I really don't see Xi wanting to invest the, you know, it's now well over $1 trillion that it would cost to reconstruct it. And so I think that he is certainly happy to have Iran be a nuisance for us and supply things that cost him very little, satellite imagery, intelligence. I mean, he has that anyway, so it's not like he's going out of his way. And the other thing is the Americans blew up one of the critical railway bridges last week that was one of the overland routes from China down through Russia into Iran. And so it's not clear to me how easy it is for them to actually do resupply at this point. So I think that Xi may be looking at this situation like a bad debt and going to see if maybe he can make some cheap purchases at the fire sale that's inevitably coming for Iran. But, you know, other than that, he doesn't seem interested in playing a more kinetic, active role, if you will.
Gordon, you have a question about China.
Victoria, in the last week or so, there's been a cottage industry of American foreign policy analysts who say that China has been the biggest victor of the Iran war so far. Some people will add Russia into that. You had Fareed Zakaria's famous column in the Washington Post. Fareed's view is, well, the region, the Gulf region, is now much closer to China and others than it is to the United States. And so, therefore, that's a big victory for the Chinese. But it seems that just yesterday, somebody named Donald John Trump came to agreement with Saudi Arabia over nuclear cooperation. And that would seem to solidify the partnership between Riyadh and Washington. Do you think the Chinese are the big winners of the Iran war so far?
No, I mean, you won't be shocked to learn I strongly disagree with Fareed on this. And I would just look I would follow the money, starting with, you know, that nuclear deal, which is going to provide massive amounts of energy for Saudi Arabia. And what that does then is put a lot more Saudi Arabian oil on the market. They've been burning their oil to generate electricity. When they get their nuclear program up and running, they won't have to do that anymore. That's why the UAE civil nuclear program, their reactor at Baraka, has been such a success for the whole GCC, because that excess electricity goes into their collective grid and has really been a great boon to the whole region. So you have that deal. You have the fact that Qatar's natural gas currently, what they're supplying to their long-term contracts isn't coming out of the Gulf, both because of the blockade and the Iranian activities, but then also because of the damage the Iranians did to that natural gas field. What Qatar is using is their natural gas exports out of Golden Pass in Texas, which came online in late March of this year, providentially, as it turned out. So if you're Japan and you're buying, you know, receiving your contracted shipment of natural gas from Qatar, that's coming from Texas right now. There could be no more visceral connection to the United States than that kind of deal. And then finally, I'd point to the visit of the new prime minister of Iraq, who's a very interesting person. We should talk about him at some point. Ali al-Zaidi, who's a young man, a business guy, came first trip abroad, came to the United States, not to Tehran, as traditionally they do, and signed $60 billion worth of deals with Chevron and Exxon. Again, follow the money. They're showing us with their checkbooks where they want to make deals, where they want their long-term economic fortunes to rest. And that's with the United States. So I think Fareed wants this to be the case. And he wants this to be a long-term strategic disaster for the United States. Now, while I admit it might be a short-term political disaster for Republicans, I think long-term we're going to see this as a benchmark moment that moves the Middle East closer to the United States, not the opposite.
The Kremlin. The Kremlin is bogged down in the Ukraine, certainly. But at the same time, there's talk that Asian nations are looking to Russia not for security, but for energy, because of the Strait of Hormuz is not obviously solved for some time, and Russia has extra capacity right now. Is that in favor of the Kremlin, or are we looking at expediency on the part of, say, the ASEAN nations, the smaller nations that have to worry about their oil supply?
No, that's definitely a factor in all of this. And it certainly doesn't make me happy when Vladimir Putin sells more oil. It may be a necessary consequence of this action. But I do think, you know, the Strait of Hormuz situation is a short-term situation. I think that is going to be resolved fairly quickly at this point. We have a plan of how to clear it. It's complicated and comes with some risk, but it exists. And at some point, somebody's going to say, hey, we just got to get this done. These are going to be, I think, short-term sales and not of vast quantities. So, you know, the major patron, the major purchaser for Putin in Asia will always be China, to some extent India. And so that's something we can get after. We can work with India on particularly natural gas exports that can satisfy their energy needs, so they're not reliant on Russian gas. And you know, there's also then the fear of sanctions, that the United States has relaxed some sanctions on Russia to allow these sales. Those sanctions could come back the way the waivers came back on the Iranian oil. recently. So I don't like it, John, but I'm not terribly exercised about it.
Do we see a lot of backslapping going on in Thailand between the Russian ambassador and the Thais? Anything like that? Unusual festive activity.
Right. And that's a traditional ally of the United States, a country we've been very close to. And so, I think we just need to pay a lot of attention to them, make sure we're satisfying whatever needs they may have, and that they know their partner of choice should remain the United States, even if they're buying a little bit more Russian oil.
Gordon, we have a minute for Victoria. Question, please.
Ukraine has been disrupting Russia's refineries. Do you think Ukraine could put an end to these oil sales? And by the way, why would anyone have a long-term or even short-term contract with Russia when Ukraine can take them out?
Well, that's another very, very good point. And I think Zelensky's been quite strategic in what he's done in terms of targeting Russia's refining capacity, because you can have all the crude in the world. If you can't turn it into gasoline, you can't put it in a car. So, that has been a very effective tool. And my hope is that as the Ukrainians continue that kind of degradation of Russian capacity, that Russia will make a decision like Stalin at the end of the Winter War against Finland, where he did claim some Finnish territory, but Finland remained intact and independent and is now a member of NATO almost 100 years later. But that's the kind of decision Putin may feel he has to make to get out of this war, to get back to business.
Victoria Coates, Vice President for the Heritage Foundation, former National Security Deputy National Security Advisor for the first Trump term, Gordon Chang at Gordon G. Chang. I'm John Batchelor. Great fun, Victoria. Thank you, thank you, thank you, thank you, thank you.
Thank you, gentlemen. Have a great one.
Yes.
You too.
Bye. Gordon, that was exciting. Good heavens. Bring back that board of risk game, Gordon. We just played it. I'm putting 30 men on Kamchatka. What are you going to do? Okay, fine. I hope everybody in the 20th century had their fill of risk, because it's back.
It certainly is.
About China, Gordon. Beijing's acting weak. They know that, yes?
I think so. They've been bystanders in the Iran war, especially in this later phases, which I think is an indication that they realize they cannot come up against a determined President Trump.
He's not traveling until he comes to Washington. What does that mean?
I wish I knew. I think he wants to appear like he's the leader of the world, so everybody has to come to him. That's part of it. I think that he is mindful of the problems inside the regime itself, so he does not want to leave because he worries about being able to come back. He's not in great health, which means he probably doesn't want to travel, regardless of the geopolitical and the domestic concerns. It's to me a mystery.
Yeah. I'm sure that a lot of junior CCP wannabes are asking that question.
Yes. Xi Jinping has been very, very... I think he's been very clever, especially over the last year. He's reconstituted his position with the civilian part of the Communist Party. He was in trouble, if you go back 12 months or so. Now he's not. He's still in trouble with the military, and that is a much bigger issue. And that would keep him alone by itself.
That would be an interpretation that would be easy to come to. He doesn't want to leave his chair because the military is not trustworthy.
Yes. A lot of people say, well, he fires generals, so he has to be in control. But no, his firing of generals shows he's not in control, because if he were in control, he wouldn't have to be firing people.
Also, he was firing people he hired, wasn't he?
Certainly.
Yeah.
And he fired Zhang Yaoshao, who once was a friend, turned into an adversary, was the most senior uniformed officer. That, I think, is a real problem for Xi Jinping. Especially because we don't know exactly what's happened to Zhang Yaoshao. Some people say he's dead. Some people say he's fighting back. And if it's the latter interpretation, then very well, Xi Jinping does not want to leave Beijing at this point.
That would be a straightforward explanation.
Yeah, and because China is so difficult to understand these days, it's just a guess. It's a guess based on things that we know, but it is speculation only.
Yeah, I get it. Well, thank you, Gordon. We meet again on Monday.
We certainly do, John.
Monday, and thanks to Lydia. And yep. The Roman Orchestra is ready, so I will turn to them a little late. No, we're on time. They always wave the union contract at me. I'm on time, guys. Okay. Give me some credit when I get it right. Here we go. Thank you, Gordon.
Thanks, John.